Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, did predatory developers use the law to confiscate thousands of acres from African American families? But first, Scholar Circle contributor Doug Becker examines the impact of President Bolsonaro's election on Brazil and globally. How does Bolsonaro compare to other populist leaders in Latin America and to President Trump?
Brazil is the largest country in South America. It's the fifth largest in the world and third largest in the Western Hemisphere. Its GDP ranks it ninth in the world, and its population is 213 million. On October the 28th, Jair Bolsonaro won the presidency of Brazil with 55.1% of the votes. He is known in many circles as the Trump of the tropics, and his election has shaken Brazilian politics and has the potential to shift Brazilian-American relations, Brazilian domestic politics, and regional politics for years to come. Today, we will discuss this development with our guests, Erica Resende, who is Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. And Guilherme Casarões, who is the lecturer of international relations at Fundação Getúlio Vargas, the São Paulo School of Business. He is the author of several peer-reviewed articles on Brazilian foreign policy and Latin American politics. He is also the author of The Evolution of Brazilian Foreign Policy Studies and Geoeconomic Competition in Latin America, Brazil, Venezuela, and Regional Integration in the 21st Century. So, Jair Bolsonaro is frequently described as a populist, which has a specific meaning in the U.S. and in Western Europe, as well as in the region in South America. Erica Resende, is this an accurate description?
In a way, it is. If you think about both Trump and Bolsonaro as belonging to the same DNA of populist regimes, both being two phenomena, a more broader global phenomenon emerging that we call populist or new populist coming up. To understand populist, a very easy working concept for that is the understanding set by Mueller, by which he understands populist as being sort of a political strategy characterized by anti-elites and anti-plural. So the idea of the populist leader in a way understanding and intuitively knowing what the people want and speaking for the people against the elite. So in a way, both Trump and Bolsonaro share some of the characteristics that we political scientists usually understand how populism works.
Now, Guilherme, populism has a specific definition in Latin America, and it's a historical one. How much does Bolsonaro resemble the old-school populists like Juan Perón and Getúlio Vargas, or the leftist populists like Hugo Chavez or Nicolas Maduro?
I think the populism in Latin America has many different strands. We have, like, left-wing populism, especially in the early 2000s. Some people try to characterize Lula, for example, as an example of modern-day populism, a left-wing. But populism can be traced back to the 1930s and 40s. If you think about Getúlio Vargas in Brazil, who was a fascist, who resorted to populist strategies during his 15-year period in office, as well as Juan Perón in Argentina. And there are so many other populists in the 1940s, both left and right. But I'd characterize Bolsonaro in a slightly different way. I think he might be considered a typical Latin American populist in the sense that he's used his charisma to push his agenda forward and to get elected, ultimately. But Bolsonaro can also be seen as part of a very contemporary wave of global populism, as Erica said. So I think it's pretty fair to compare Bolsonaro to Trump in this regard. Now, let me just pick up on this. I think it's important to understand that Bolsonaro, he adopted the very same strategy and the very same narrative as Trump's. So a great deal of his election has a lot to do with the way he built his campaign. And I think that we can think about it in strategic terms, with the very intense use of social networks and direct communication with the people. So he resorted a lot to Twitter, Facebook, and most specifically WhatsApp as instruments for reaching out to people directly. And of course, there was a lot of fake news going around as well. But I'd say that there's also something about the narrative of Bolsonaro, which has less to do with traditional Latin American populism, and it has a lot to do with Trump's narrative, too. Bolsonaro portrayed himself as the bearer of the truth of the average person in Brazil, which I think was something very common among Americans during the 2016 elections. The idea that Bolsonaro was the only true interpreter of the average person in Brazil or in the United States. This was something very, very powerful during the campaign. And I picture Bolsonaro, too, as member of this anti-globalist wave. I'm not sure if these are the terms they're using in the United States, too, but if I can recall, I think it was Steve Bannon who coined the term globalism and applied the term in many debates of American politics. And Bolsonaro also portrayed himself as this man who's fighting the tyranny of globalism around the world and who wants to restore the traditional values of Brazilians, of the average Brazilian. So he basically talked a lot about God, and that, by the way, was his motto during the campaign. Brazil above everyone and God above everybody or something like this. And also family and the nation. So there was a very strong component of nationalism in Bolsonaro's rhetoric, which equates him to Trump and to other global phenomena, too.
Now, Eric Arasende, on this theme of the similarities between Bolsonaro and Trump, one that has certainly been noted is gender constructions, and in particular, issues of masculinity. The idea that Bolsonaro represents a kind of a return to a traditional masculinity. Is that a pretty accurate description? And how much do you see a reaction against the rise of women in Brazilian politics behind some of Bolsonaro's support?
Actually, what some political scientists that study the phenomenon of populism had already pointed out is that populism as a political style has one or two specific characteristics that in the current populist regimes that are emerging, this populism expresses itself with a performance of crisis and bad manners. So in those two specific characteristics, there is a very deep similarity between Trump and Bolsonaro. So in the example of the bad manners, the way that the masculinity, the white masculinity, Christian masculinity emerges both with Trump and Bolsonaro are very similar. One example of how this showed up in Bolsonaro political discourse regarding women during the presidential campaign was in many times that he referred to as being the that he has four sons, and all of them are studs. And one time that he was not careful enough, and boom, and then he had a daughter. So he's constantly downplaying the role of women. He had traditionally, when he was at the House of Representatives, at the Brazilian Parliament, he had a very tense relation with two or three key Brazilian women that are in the House of Parliament. But this expresses what political science term the bad manners component. So be it towards women or gay people or as well as blacks, this bad manner has to be performed in a way as to approach Bolsonaro, the populist leader, to the common people. And at the same time, the strategy of bad manners also conveys the idea that political correctness is a liberal discourse, a liberal attitude that cannot be tolerated anymore. And a second characteristic that I think it's very similar to
Trump, between Trump and Bolsonaro, is the performance of crisis, of threat. So in order for the populist discourse to take on, there has to be a continuous framing of there is a crisis, there is an overwhelming existential threat. So in the case of the U.S., I think this can be seen how Trump has in many number of times played the card against migration, and specifically migration coming from Mexico, from Latin America, the Latino migration. And in Brazil, Bolsonaro plays the card of security, public safety. The fact that many of Brazilian big cities have experienced very high numbers in terms of crime. So the performance of this crisis, a threat that has to be going on in order for the populist discourse to, in a way, to be able to mobilize support, and the bad manners. So both characteristics are present, I think, both in Trump and in Bolsonaro.
Guilherme Casarojas, you had mentioned about nationalism as one of the real key components of Bolsonaro's rise. And I know that you've done quite a bit of work in Latin America. Are there any regional implications, relations, you know, with neighboring countries, with Bolsonaro's, you know, seeming turn inward with this, you know, rise of nationalism as a part of his discourse?
Well, the curious thing about Bolsonaro's foreign policy platform is that it tries to combine a very strong sense of nationalism. And it's a very specific kind of nationalism which tries to bring Brazil closer to the West. The idea of Brazil as a Western country, one of the strongest components of the kind of nationalist narrative that Bolsonaro is trying to put forth. But there is also this very liberal idea, too, especially economically. So at the same time, unlike the United States, for example, in which there was a combination of nationalism and protectionism behind the rhetoric of making America great again. In the case of Brazil, there is this nationalism trying to put Brazil into the Western Hemisphere and at the same time opening up Brazil's economy. And I think it reflects different groups that are part of the Bolsonaro administration. You have the group of liberal economists led by Paulo Guedes, who's the Minister of the Economy in Brazil. And he's very liberal. He's trying to restore the credibility of Brazil's economy and on liberal grounds. So he talks a lot about opening up the economy, about free trade agreements, about reaching out to liberal neighbors such as Colombia or Chile. And there is the other group, which is the anti-globalist group, led by Foreign Minister Ernesto Araújo, who's the disciple of philosopher, or so-called philosopher, Olavo de Carvalho, who's Brazil's Steve Bannon. So there's this very strong anti-globalist component of in Brazil's foreign policy making, which is also very noteworthy. So we have this dichotomy, this paradox in Brazil's rhetoric, which is at the same time very nationalist and very liberal. And of course, it has a very deep impact on how Brazil behaves in the region. Because at the same time, Brazil has abandoned most of the regional integration structures that it has or that it had built in the past. So, for example, Mercosur, which is a free trade and customs union bloc that Brazil launched in 1991 together with Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay, Mercosur is almost dead by now. Nobody in the government has been talking about Mercosur. And curiously enough, Mercosur is historically one of the most important initiatives of Brazil's foreign policy. It would be the South American equivalent to the European Union, roughly speaking. So nobody's talking about Mercosur anymore. And the relationship between Bolsonaro and Brazil's neighbors has been very narrow in the sense that he only seems to be interested in doing free trade with countries like Chile. And they even have this new bloc that Chile has created. It's called Prosur. I don't know exactly what it stands for. I think it's a sort of political bloc of conservative leaders in South America. So it's something very new that Bolsonaro is trying to be part of. But basically, Brazil has lost much of its interest in constructing the regional order around the Brazilian interests. So that, I think, it's the most important thing. For the last 25 years, Brazil has led the regional integration process in South America. And ever since President Rousseff, back in 2015 or 16, Brazil has practically abandoned the desire of building institutions or sustaining institutions and making sure that the regional order would favor Brazil's interests. And if we look at the most concrete issue that most South American countries are having to deal with, which is the Venezuelan crisis, Brazil is no longer the leader of the debates. Brazil is no longer trying to mediate the conflict in Venezuela. Brazil is actually jumping in the American bandwagon in dealing with Venezuela. And when Bolsonaro went to the United States last month, one of the things that he said was that Brazil would subscribe to any policy undertaken by the United States towards Venezuela, including a military intervention. So, and that was very new to Brazilian foreign policy, and that has a deep implication in the relationship between Brazil and South America, because one of the cornerstones of Brazil's foreign policy towards the region was the total respect for our neighbor's sovereignty. And this is something that Bolsonaro is probably going to abandon in the middle run if the United States decides to invade Venezuela.
Very, very interesting. Erica, would you like to follow up?
Yes, I want to add just a little bit on the nationalism, because I think this is a very interesting and a peculiar component within Bolsonaro in Brazil. Because when we say nationalist, I don't think the nationalist should be equated with usually traditionally how nationalism is understood within an European context, like German nationalism or French nationalism, about the nation. It's not that. Whenever Bolsonaro brings up the question of being the nationalist or the national conservative, it's a specific understanding of nationalism that is in a way very much connected to his history as a former military man. For Brazilian armed forces, there is a very strong perception that Brazil, in a way, is in a constant fear under threat of fragmentation due to a multicultural agenda, the international to transnational dynamics, the existence and functioning of NGOs, international NGOs, for example, in the rainforest. So those are specifically and pretty much concerns within a specific branch of the Brazilian military armed forces, and has to do more with a nationalism in terms of keeping a national cohesion, more in the terms of a pride and the cohesion of the nation, more than the specific nationalistics and against foreigners in the nation.
Very interesting. I know there's been a great deal of conversation about the role of the military in Brazilian politics. Is this potentially manifesting itself in Brazil, increasing the size of its military or increasing spending on the military and even possibly having its military participating in some sort of, armed intervention either in the region or some critical place around the world?
As you know, I work for the Brazilian Armed Forces. I am an assistant professor at the Brazilian War College. And one thing that I think should be made clear to our audience overseas is that the military forces in Brazil are not cohesive in terms of how they stand regarding Venezuela. There are groups within the armed forces, because there's also the Navy, Army, and Air Force. So there are groups. There is a generational gap between people who are occupying low and higher ranks. But one thing that really strikes me as peculiar, so to speak, is that, first of all, regarding the participation of military armed forces within the government. Not even during the military regime, there has been so many military retired or in active duty within the government. Never. The last data that I was able to read about 2 days ago, it was close to 100 retired military men occupying high-ranking levels of the Brazilian government, national government. So this is very unusual. Not even during the military regime was like that. But second, what I think also it's quite interesting, the budget of the Brazilian Defense Ministry is considerable, but mostly due to a spending regarding pensions and wages, not as much as, for example, the acquisition of arms and vessels, things like that. Second, I think also interesting to mention that there is a sort of a division of labor between the armed forces, and it's understood that, for example, if there's a spillover regarding Venezuela into national borders, the Brazilian borders, this will be something that will be taken care of by the army. So the army right now, especially high-ranking officials, are a little bit more vocal in the background, trying to calm down or acting as doves, so to speak, regarding a possible Brazilian participation in a multilateral force led by the United States. So it's a very unusual situation where military, for example, generals and colonels and the top ranks are mostly working and functioning as doves against civilian hawks, which is quite interesting, I think.
Although rather similar to the United States when thinking about, for instance, General Mattis.
Yes.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I am Doug Becker. Today we are examining the impact of Jair Bolsonaro's election in Brazil with Erica Resende of the Brazilian War College and Guilherme Casarojas of the Fundação Getúlio Vargas, the Sao Paulo School of Business. Now, Guilherme, from a foreign policy perspective, I know one area there's been a great deal of concern among international environmentalists about Brazil's commitment, for instance, to the Paris Climate Accords. Some talk about whether or not Brazil might increase deforestation in Amazonia. And I know there's been some news stories about granting mining rights that could be an infringement on indigenous populations. Is this overblown, or should environmentalists be concerned about Brazil's environmental policy and the potential impact on its foreign policy?
I think it's a real problem. Let me just get back to something that Erica said.
Please do.
It's very interesting to point out that the military, they have become a very key player, a very central force in the Brazilian government. But I don't think that the military want to seize power, or at least not like the military dictatorship of the 1960s and 70s. The military want to keep the country stable, and they see some very present threats, such as international NGOs or, I don't know, organized crime, drug traffickers, and so on and so forth. And this is why they are there. By the way, the environment has historically been one of the most delicate issues. If we think about the military regime in Brazil in the 1970s, for example, one of the strongest positions of the military was to preserve the Amazon, not because they loved the environment, but because they needed to preserve and to safeguard the resources that are below the trees, right? So graphene, niobium, some of the minerals that the military feels very important for the defense industry or nuclear reactions or whatever. So they've always adopted a very defensive stance when it came to the environment. So I think that if it depends on the military, they will do their best to prevent international NGOs and activists and environmentalists to meddle with Brazilian environmental agenda. And this is a backlash compared to what we witnessed in the last 20 to 25 years. Brazil has become in the last quarter century, one of the most active players in the environmental discussions. Brazil has led many of the debates that led to the environmental or the climate change conferences and so on and so forth. So this is probably going to roll back, and I really think it's a problem at this point. But it's not just about the military. If we have a broader perspective of the government, we're going to see that the anti-globalist group is also very much against this sort of environmental activism. Foreign Minister Araújo is one of these folks. He wrote a couple of months ago that the environmental discussion was part of cultural Marxist plot against Brazil. So he basically claims that the Paris Agreement was part of a Marxist left-wing plot to destroy the Brazilian culture or something along these lines. I didn't really understand the logic of the argument, but this is something that he wrote and that's still there on his personal blog. So the anti-globalists, the military, and even some other members of the government, such as Environment Minister Ricardo Salles, he's basically a farmer who has a track record of disregarding environmental laws and making them more flexible for farmers and for the big agribusiness players to destroy the environment. So basically we have a government which is not committed whatsoever to protecting the environment. And that might cause a very big impact on Brazil's image abroad, because Brazil's reputation, especially in terms of environment, has been very, very visible. I mean, Brazil has become one of the most active players on the environmental chessboard, and this is probably going to disappear very soon.
I have also another issue that I wanted to point out. Guilherme talked about this rollback in climate change, environmental aspects and policy, but you also have to understand that this rollback is also occurring in other policies, such as migration, global health, humanitarian aid, human rights. So in a way, Brazil has been investing quite a lot and for quite a considerable time as being or presenting itself as a normative power in a way that establishes its credentials and trying to have a voice and trying to make a difference in influencing some of those policy making at more of a global governance level. And what we see is this rollback, so in migration, in health, in the fight against AIDS, HIV. So this is not something specific to environmental and climate change policy.
And another policy that I know there's been some global pushback against Brazil has been on LGBTQ rights. In March of 2018, one of Brazil's most famous activists, Marielle Franco, was assassinated. And there have been a number of stories that have linked those attitudes. Certainly Bolsonaro has made some pretty brash statements about gay rights and his lack of support for those. This seems to be an area of particular concern. Would you share that concern, Erica?
This is not new for him. This is not about Marielle Franco, the fact that she was black and lesbian, the second most voted city council elected in Rio de Janeiro, in the city of Rio de Janeiro. It was not about her, because this didn't happen with her. Actually, most of Bolsonaro's 27 years as a member of the House of Representatives in Brasilia, and there are quite a number of instances and cases where he was very vocal against, and in a way, very, again, the bad manners characteristic, against gay, openly gay congresses and congressmen, against most of the multiculturalist agenda, against, for example, when the bill was about the same-sex marriage. So there are many of cases in the last 20-something years, so it was not specific towards Marielle. One of Bolsonaro's key, so to say, adversaries was an openly gay congressman, also elected from Rio de Janeiro. His name is Jean Willis. He left Brazil and applied for a refugee status in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. And both of them
went on and on in very different moments throughout the last, I don't know, 5-6 years. And one specifically one, there was name-calling and things like that within the house. So it's not something that was directly new because of Mariela. What was, I think, one key element within Mariela is that her assassination played a key role within the presidential campaign, mostly because Bolsonaro's three sons were also campaigning, one of them for senator, another for a representative, national representative, another one for city council. And all of them, especially regarding the politics within the city of Rio, were seen, for example, in outside during March and things like that, trying to downplay the symbol that Marielle Franco has become in the last year. And also there is some controversy regarding a possible ties between one of his sons with militia groups that have been officially been accused of being involved with Marielle Franco's assassination.
Many of us here in the U.S. have been asking, is the election of Trump in 2016 a sign of real political movement shifting rightward, shifting internally, shifting as part of a nationalist agenda and a nationalist campaign and nationalist discourse? So I'd like to ask the same question of both of you in Brazil. Should we read this as kind of just a moment in history with the rise of Bolsonaro? And I think of things like the collapse of the Labor Party of the PT and really some terrible political decision-making that led to the 2018 election. So is this something that we're going to see as, you know, a one-and-done with the election of Bolsonaro? Or is this a real political movement and Brazilian politics have shifted to the right, likely, if not permanently, at least in the medium term, possibly for the long term? I'll ask Guilherme first and then Erica.
I think that there are basically two processes that started in 2013 that might shed light on what's going on in Brazil. And there's obviously a global wave of conservative politicians and populist politicians, which also helps explain this whole thing. But let me start by saying that we've witnessed in Brazil, ever since 2013, a huge number of popular demonstrations. And the biggest of them took place in 2013. Many people even considered these demonstrations as part of the Brazilian Spring, which took more than 1 million people to the streets in many different capitals in Brazil, and mostly organized through Facebook and WhatsApp and so on and so forth. So 2013 was the moment people realized that they could have at least a little bit of power or the upper hand in shaping their own political destinies. And that was an unprecedented thing. If we look at the track record of Brazil's popular demonstrations, they have been very sparse over time. So we had some of these demonstrations in the early 2000s because of the FTAA negotiations. We had some demonstrations in the 1990s that led to the impeachment of President Collor. But 2013 was different because these demonstrations, they became massive and they became very recurring. So that was a very important thing. And then there is a second element adding to that, which is the beginning of car wash operation, which was a graft probe, right, in 2014. And car wash was important because the investigations that led to the imprisonment of so many politicians in Brazil ever since 2014, it basically destroyed the political establishment of the country. And it had a very specific impact on the Workers' Party, which is the party of Lula and President Rousseff as well, the Social Democratic Party of former President Cardoso, and that was the second party force in Brazil in the democratic period, and it also affected the PMDB, which is the Democratic Movement Party, the strongest party in Brazil in terms of seats in the parliament. So basically, the traditional party structures in Brazil have been destroyed, or at least partially destroyed by the car wash operation investigations. So the combination of people in the streets, which gave people the feeling of a new path to politics or a new form of making politics on the one hand, and the car wash operations, which basically fostered this anti-establishment sentiment among people. These two things combined led to the rise of anti-system or anti-establishment politicians such as Bolsonaro. Now, one thing which is important to point out is that Bolsonaro is far from being a typical anti-establishment politician, so he's not like Trump in the sense that he was a complete outsider who jumped into politics at the right time, so to speak. Bolsonaro had been a congressman for almost 30 years, so he had to create this narrative of belonging to this anti-establishment side or the narrative of not belonging to the system. But that was fabricated, to be very specific. That was fabricated between 2016 and 2018. So I think that these two structural conditions paved the way for Bolsonaro to rise, and combining this movement with the global wave of conservative and anti-globalist and populist politicians, I think that we had the very specific combination or recipe for Bolsonaro to get elected. And of course, it doesn't stop here, in the sense that maybe within the next couple of years, we're going to see regional Bolsonaros popping up, not only in Brazilian states, as we saw in last year's election. So we have many, many Bolsonaros in some of the most important states in Brazil, such as São Paulo, Minas Gerais, or Rio de Janeiro, but also Bolsonaros popping up in Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and so on and so forth. So this might be one of the most important implications of Bolsonaro's rise in Brazil, the rise of similar politicians with very similar narratives across South America.
Erica Resende, I'll give you the last word on this question.
One thing that I want to point out is that I think it's too early to have any understanding or place any bets regarding the next few years here in Brazil. In fact, it was yesterday, Bolsonaro celebrated 100 days in office. In those 100 days, what we have seen so far is not basically accomplished and almost no substantial policy change. What we have seen so far is an expression by a political scientist here in Brazil calling, we left during Lula and Rousseff presidency. Brazil lived under a presidentialism of coalition building, as many, as broad as possible, and encompassing as many political parties as possible. But with Bolsonaro, what we have seen so far is a shift towards presidentialism of confrontation. It's a constant confrontation within the cabinet members and Congress and the judiciary and the Supreme Court against the press. I mean, it's an ongoing confrontation. But this also has to do a little bit with the characteristics of populism as a global phenomenon, specifically when a discourse does not engage politically between adversaries, people that might have different political stands, positional ideologies, but now enemies. So politics does not make adversaries or competitors anymore, but enemies. So an antagonism that is produced by populism is the one that makes political life really hard, because it sets in a track towards a permanent, ongoing confrontation between people within the government and outside the government, with the press, between the different branches of government. And so it begs the question, and I think right now this is the question behind everybody's mind here in Brazil, is will Bolsonaro be actually able to go through the next 4 years or not? So I don't think right now the question that we should be asking is what about the next election, but rather, is he going to live to see the next election? Is he going to be able to remain as president until the next election?
That question was arisen in the United States, and a concern about whether or not President Trump was going to serve through his first term. But I will admit that that issue is even more salient in Brazil, because at least the U.S. has a little bit better of a track record of presidents making their way to the end of their term than Brazilians have. So I'd like to thank Erica Resende and Guillerme Casares for your time, your expertise, and informing an American and a global audience more about what's going on in Brazil. I like to teach my classes as ongoing political dramas, and I find no more fascinating and consequential drama in the world than what's going on in Brazil. So thank you very much.
You're welcome, Douglas.
Erica Resende is Assistant Professor of International Relations and Security Studies at the Brazilian War College in Rio de Janeiro. She's the co-editor of Memory and Trauma in International Relations and Crisis and Change in Post-Cold War Global Politics. Guilherme Casares is the lecturer of international relations at Fundação Getúlio Vargas, the São Paulo School of Business. He is also the author of The Evolution of Brazilian Foreign Policy Studies and Geoeconomic Competition in Latin America, Brazil, Venezuela, and Regional Integration in the 21st Century.
When we come back, how did predatory developers use the law to confiscate thousands of acres from African American families? Stay tuned.
There have been times that I thought I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gon' come.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Did predatory developers use the law to confiscate thousands of acres from African American families? Our next guest says yes. Leah Douglas is an analyst and a reporter with Open Markets Program at New America Foundation. Her investigative article, African Americans Have Lost Untold Acres of Land Over the Last Century, was published by The Nation magazine. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Leah Douglas. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the pieces that we wanted to talk with you about is the piece that you wrote about African Americans losing untold acres of land over the last century. You started your article with a story of a man who bought land in Hilton Head back in 1897. But now the family is struggling with the legal system to give that property to his heirs. Can you explain this, what happened and what the problem is exactly?
So my story follows one family, the Allen family. They're from Hilton Head, South Carolina, as they fight to retain their ancestral land, which, as you mentioned, was originally purchased in 1897. Essentially, the land is vulnerable to being bought out from underneath the family because it's owned as heirs' property, which is a very common type of land ownership in which there was never a will made in the chain of descendants who own the land. And so every descendant of the original owner of the property has an equal share to the land. The title was never written in a single person's name. An heir's property is vulnerable to being bought out through a legal mechanism called a partition sale, which basically empowers every co-tenant of the property to petition the court to bring the whole parcel of land to court-ordered auction. So partition sales have been a driving force behind land loss in many low-income communities, particularly in the African-American community in the South. So what often happens in these instances is a predatory developer or other moneyed interest might target one of the many co-tenants, the descendants of the original owner, for a plot of land and offer them a sum of money to buy them out from their share. And then once that developer is themselves a co-tenant, they can petition to bring the whole parcel of land to auction and buy it themselves. And so that legal maneuver has been used, for instance, on the island of Hilton Head, on that island to promote the expansion of hotels and resorts and other large developments. This particular type of legal mechanism is, some estimate, is responsible for about 50% of land loss in certain areas of the South in the Black community.
Let's break this down so that we understand exactly what happened. Let's use the Allens as an example. They owned a very big plot of land, right? But it's owned by a lot of different heirs.
Right. So in the case of the Allens, they own a 38-acre plot on Hilton Head, which is today the largest undeveloped plot that's owned by African Americans that remains on the island. And there are over 100 members of the Allen family who each have a claim to that land. So those folks are all descendants of the original owner, Dennis Allen, who was the original purchaser of the land in the late 1800s.
And then how is it that this predatory developer, as you called it, you said they convince one person who owns a part of this property to sell, and then that leaves the rest vulnerable? How does that work?
So this isn't exactly the case of the Allen family, but it's a common instance that has occurred in other families. So say there's a family member who grew up on the West Coast, and they didn't even know that there was family land in South Carolina, for instance. And they could be contacted out of the blue by a legal firm or a developer who says, hey, guess what? You have a stake in this land, and we're going to offer you $5,000 for it. And so, you know, if they had no idea, they might think, oh, okay, great, free money. What do I know about that piece of land? But as in many families, there may be actually that person's distant relatives living on the land, or there may be emotional connection to the land in another branch of the family that they're just not aware of. So that is a common scenario that's happened in many families. And then once the developer, whoever it is that bought that person out, has a stake in the land, they have the same rights as any other heirs property owner. So they can petition the courts to bring the land to a court-ordered auction. And there only needs to be, well, historically, there's needed to be very little notice of those auctions. And then the developer itself can buy the whole piece of land, generally at dramatically below the market value of the land.
You mentioned in your piece, too, that there are certain types of lawyers that play a role in all this. How so?
Well, in the case of the Allen family, they got involved initially with a lawyer who was a well-known heirs property lawyer on the island, had worked with other families on settling heirs property cases. And the Allen family got involved with this lawyer. Some member of the family began to work with him. It's unclear if their relationship was ever formalized. But he was the person who initially brought the family into the court, made the initial petition to sell the land, that today the vast majority of the family members say their signatures were forged or they didn't want to sell the land. They weren't alerted that the land was going to be sold. So this lawyer was acting without their consent is the allegation of the family today. But this lawyer had also, unbeknownst to the family, been leveraging his role as an heir's property lawyer to, in one case, you know, bring a family's piece of land to auction and then collect the profits for himself. He was actually about to stand trial for those allegations that he had stolen money from families that he was helping to clear their titles to their land and other heirs property related issues, but he committed suicide the day that he was supposed to stand trial. So we don't have his side of the story about what happened. But, you know, there have been instances that families have described, like that one where the lawyers themselves are corrupted, or in a small place like Hilton Head, you know, might have a relationship with a developer or some other interest beyond simply the interests of their clients that they're representing.
And how much land are we actually talking about?
Well, it's hard to know because there's not very many good estimates. The best estimate for the area in South Carolina where I was doing my research, the Center for Heirs Property Preservation down in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is near coastal South Carolina where the story is based, estimates that there's 105,000 acres in their 15-county service area that's been sort of in the low country of South Carolina and the eastern shore of the state. So that's just one section of one state, and heirs property exists all over the country. In any region where there are landowners who don't have access to legal services or low-income landowners, it's common for there to be heirs property because basically heirs property only indicates that there hasn't been access to will-making in the lineage of the land. So there's many, many, many thousands of acres, and it's unknown exactly how much land has been lost via partition sale.
So in your article, you had mentioned that, you know, after the Civil War, that freed slaves and their descendants had about 15 million acres of land across the United States, most of it in the South. In terms of that number, do you have a sense of what percent ended up in this problem, passing it on to the heirs?
Well, in terms of exact acreage, it's hard to know, but it has been estimated that about 40% of land loss in the Black American community has occurred because of partition sale, which, and partition sales are linked specifically, for the most part, to heirs' property ownership. So in terms of acreage, you know, many millions of acres could be estimated to have been lost in this way.
All of the different factors that came into play, there's like a bunch of things that happened, it seemed like. Of course, there's discrimination. And you mentioned this systematic discrimination by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Walk us through these types of factors that came together and made this problem.
Of course, partition sales are just one of many many structural issues that have excluded African Americans from land ownership in the U.S. And there is a very well-documented history of racial discrimination and gender-based discrimination in the Department of Agriculture's lending offices. And so throughout the 20th century, the primary way for especially low-income and low-resource landowners to access farm loans was through regional and local USDA offices, just their local elected USDA officials. And those offices were, you know, pretty much in the South run as sort of a good old boys club and were extremely racially exclusive. And the dynamics there very much mirrored the politics of the Jim Crow South and other racial conflicts of the time. And so African-American landowners as well as, or, you know, aspiring landowners, as well as Native American and Hispanic and other racial and ethnic minorities were generally and often excluded from accessing loans through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And because farming is such a loan-dependent industry, it's really almost impossible to achieve any type of scale in modern agriculture without access to credit. And so many, you know, many, many thousands of farmers were excluded from accessing, you know, from growing their farms to scale or even from owning farm equipment or lands in the first place because of racial discrimination. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has settled several lawsuits with class action lawsuits with African-American and Native American and Hispanic and women farmers to address those claims of discrimination. And there were other factors as well throughout the 20th century. Of course, the Great Migration was responsible for relocating millions of thousands of people from the South to the North and was resulted in some land loss or land transfer and also general phenomenon of industrialization, moving folks off of the farm and into the cities as well. So those are all some driving factors.
You were looking primarily at South Carolina, and you called it ground zero of African-American partition sales. Do you know what goes on in the other states?
Well, partition sales are an issue in other states as well, and there are active nonprofits and government initiatives to provide legal services and assistance for heirs property owners in North Carolina, Georgia, Mississippi, really many other states. And as I say in my article, the recent passage of the Uniform Heirs Property Act in about 10 states demonstrates that, you know, there are many states where, and growing, I mean, the list continues to grow where that law is being passed. And that demonstrates that there's a strong interest and need in reforming law related to heirs property across the country. My focus was on South Carolina specifically, but certainly this issue exists elsewhere too.
And have you found that there have been decent remedies?
Well, in my story, I detail the passage of the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act in South Carolina. And that's uniform law written by a man named Thomas Mitchell, who is sort of the preeminent scholar on heirs property. And it was really a big win when South Carolina passed this law because, as Thomas Mitchell says, the state is sort of ground zero, as you said as well, for partition sales and for land loss through this mechanism. And basically what the Heirs Property Act does is it provides some more protections for heirs property owners if they do find themselves in a legal battle of some kind. For instance, if a co-tenant, if one of the many heirs initiates the sale of the land, the other tenants have to be notified and given an opportunity to buy them out before the land can be sent to auction. The law also requires judges to make considerations about the land's sentimental or historical value, where historically they've only been required to consider its economic and market value. And that's really important for families like the Allen family, whose ancestors had been previously enslaved and bought the land after, you know, really worked hard to earn that land. And it means something beyond just the economic value to the family. So the passage of the Uniform Partition of Heirs Property Act in many states is definitely seen as a huge step forward. But until, you know, this is only in September of 2016 that the law was passed in South Carolina. And until that point, there had been relatively little legal protection for heirs property owners who were facing a possible partition action.
Well, one of the things you noted towards the end of the article was about the rise of ownership among African Americans of agricultural lands.
In the 2012 Census of Agriculture from the USDA showed that the number of farms with black principal operators is their word, had risen 9% since 2007. And that 2007 had been the prior census of agriculture. And there's some discussion in the farming community about the USDA changed their metric for what a principal operator was during that interim. So the statistics are not exactly the same, but it still demonstrates that there has been a rise in ownership. And certainly the Department of Agriculture has worked hard to encourage and provide programs and support and lending for small and beginning and minority farmers. Under the Obama administration, they introduced a microloan program to make it easier for small farmers to access capital and have had some success bringing in low-income and marginalized farmers through that program. So there is some indication that land ownership is on the rise in the African-American community and in other marginalized rural communities. However, it is, you know, seen against this backdrop of, at one time, black farmers represented about 14% of all farmers in the U.S. in around 1920, and today as less than 2%. So it's still, we're still dealing with a dramatic decrease from where the numbers once were.
To conclude, let's tie this into the food economy work that you've done previously, where you essentially found the consolidation is really harming our food economy.
In my journalism, I focus primarily on consolidated business and how the rise of corporations and corporate agriculture has negatively affected folks in the food supply chain, from farmers to farm workers to distributors and to retailers and consumers as well. And so, you know, since the 1980s in particular, we've seen dramatic consolidation of our food economy. Most commonly seen by consumers are big mergers in, for instance, the beer industry or the Amazon buying Whole Foods, that type of major acquisition. We've also seen roll-ups in the tractor industry and enormous consolidation in the seed and agrochemical industry, and those types of mergers and buy-ups really affect farmers. Consolidation can be seen as another factor that further aggravates issues of marginalization among African-American farming communities on top of already this historical structural oppression that that community has faced.
Well, Leah Douglas, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Leah Douglas is an analyst and a reporter with Open Markets Program at New America Foundation. Her investigative article, African Americans Have Lost Untold Acres of Land Over the Last Century, was published by The Nation magazine. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.